Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts over there. Also, while you're over there, you can go to the events page because we got events coming up in 2020, city events in both Houston and Las Vegas. We're going to be in Houston on February 22nd and Las Vegas March 21st. Both those are free events. All you got to do is sign up and show up. You can go sign up on the website or you can go look in the show notes here if you're listening to this on an app or on the site. And click down and just click on the event, sign up, and come join us in Houston. I'll be there. Chad will be there. Loso, Gretchen Ronovic, Matt Popovitz, and Scott Keith. And we're going to talk about what happens when people encounter Jesus. And then in Las Vegas, we're going to be going over the entire book of Galatians. Eric Sorensen, Adam Francisco, Scott Keith, Cindy Koch, Blake Flatley, and myself. So love to see you at those events. Also, if you're in Germany, the Great Freedom Conference, we would love to see our German listeners out there. That thing is filling up. There's a link in the show notes to that as well. If you happen to live in Germany and would like to come hang out with us, we would absolutely love to see you. That's the first weekend in May. And we're excited to go to Germany and birthplace of the Reformation and talk about Christian freedom. So it's going to be a great time. Chad, how's it going, man?
It's going well. It's going well. If you follow me on Facebook, I mentioned about a week ago that I signed a contract, book contract with 1517 on, of all things, something Old Testament related.
No way.
Strange, huh? Yeah. No. Weird. No, so I'm writing a 365 days, so a whole year's devotional book. And each day we'll look at a particular Hebrew word or phrase and unpack that and connect it to Christ, of course, and the New Testament. So I have been like hammering those out. I mean, there's a bunch up, but I mean, I think I wrote the 27th one this morning.
Yeah.
You know, which is like, oh, that's so cool. That's a lot. And then then I think, yeah, you got to write 365 of these things. So I got a ways to go, but hey, at least I'm making progress.
Yeah, right? Man.
At least I'm making progress. So that's what I've been working on, that and getting ready for, I'm going to St. Louis this weekend. I got three different events coming up there. So hopefully I'll get to meet some of you guys there.
Yeah, the weather up there is terrible right now. It's terrible.
I know,
here. We had school canceled today and everything, man. There was snow everywhere and ice everywhere today. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I heard something about a winter storm possibly moving in the Midwest and I thought, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah.
I guess we'll see. Oh, well, we'll make it work one way or another.
The real question is, are you going to cover my favorite Hebrew word?
Which is what?
Hesed.
Of course. Okay. Yeah. Gotta cover Hesed.
Did you already cover it? You already got it down?
No, I have not covered that. Kind of what I've been doing is I started, I wrote out the list. So I've got all the whole list written out. And I'm sure I'll tweak that as I go through. But what I did is basically started with Genesis 1 right now. I think I just finished, where am I at, about Genesis 11? Yeah, I wrote something about the Tower of Babel. So I'm just kind of working my way canonically through it. And then, at some point, I'll probably start jumping around a little bit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But Hesed will be in there. Hesed will show up, though.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right. That's good. That's good. That's the one I'll read and let you know if I agree. So,
I'll put it on your birthday. Maybe that's what I'll do.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you need some help with Hesed, I've done a lot of thinking about this word. So.
All right. I will. Hit you up.
All right. So I think we're right up against Judges chapter 3.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to grab a couple of verses from chapter 2 because it flows. The subject addressed at the beginning of 3 actually begins at the end of 2. And I can't remember if we talked about it last time. So just kind of touch on that. And then we got some great, great stuff coming up. So we're going to meet our first judge. We've actually met him before, but he was kind of a side figure back in Joshua, as well as early in Judges, a guy named Othniel. We'll get to him. And we have one of my favorite biblical stories.
Oh,
I mean, it's just like top, one of the best. It's the story of the judge named Ehud and the fat king named Eglon. Oh. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's the best. It's it's full of sarcasm and wit and irony and some gruesome stuff. So yeah, it'll be fun.
Let's do it.
All right. So back at the end of chapter 2, we have the language of testing that is interwoven in the in these verses. So it says, of course, what we talked about so far is that, you know, the Israelites aren't doing, of course, what they were supposed to do. They didn't drive out the Canaanites. And instead, they're just kind of settling down and doing all sorts of things they shouldn't do, like intermarrying with them and residing among them and serving their gods. So understandably and expectedly, God's anger burns. That's verse 20 of chapter 2. And he says, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to drive out the nations anymore that Joshua left. He says, I'm going to leave them there. This is verse 22, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk in it as their fathers did or not. So there's a couple things I want to point out here. First of all, back to verse 20, it says, because this nation has transgressed my covenant. Now, you can't really see that in the English, but there's a jab there at Israel. Typically, when the Hebrew word goy or goyim, that's singular and plural, goy is nation, goyim, nations. Typically, in fact, almost without exception, when those Hebrew words are used, they're in reference to the Gentiles. So the people of God, the word there is am, and that's usually referring to Israel. But in this particular verse, Israel is called goy, this nation. So there's already an implicit indication of the gradual, what we talked about before, that the canonization of Israel throughout the period of the judges. So they're becoming like the Gentile nations, in other words. And they're left there, God says, these other nations, in order to test Israel. We've seen this word test. It came up multiple times in the Torah. The first time we saw it was actually when God tested Abraham, Genesis 22, and said, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and sacrifice him. So this was God testing Abraham. We also read in Deuteronomy that God was testing Israel throughout their 40 years in the wilderness to see if they would keep his way or not. That's the same language we have here in the book of Judges. Now, I looked, and I might have missed one, but as far as I can tell, there's only one case, and it's in Judges, where someone is allowed to test God without negative ramifications. Now, like I said, I could have missed one, but this is the only one I saw. Most of the time when somebody tests God, it ain't good. It's not going to go well for those people. But when we get to the story of Gideon, remember he has the whole fleece, and one time the fleece is wet, ground is dry. One time the fleece is dry, ground is wet. Well, in one of the, I can't remember the verse, but in one of those verses, it says that he was wanting to test one more test. And in that particular case, he's not chastised. So most of the time, almost without exception, if you test God, not good. God tests you, it's to see if you follow his way or not. And of course, as we're going to see as the story unfolds, this testing leads to Israel's repeated failure.
Yeah, well, so, this is why you have not to test the Lord.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I'm glad you said that because it reminded me that this is when Jesus is tempted by the devil to leap off the pinnacle of the temple. He responds with that verse from Deuteronomy, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. Now, in the Hebrew, Deuteronomy is that same verb that's used here, to nasa, to test Israel. So anyway, that's why they're left, in other words, in order to test Israel. And then we jump into chapter 3, and we have a list of the nations that were left. It says, these are the nations which were left, and they are the five lords of the Philistines. I'll come back to those in just a minute. And the Canaanites, and the Sidonians, and the Hivites, who lived in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon as far as Lebo Hamath. So all of these people are left there in order to be a test to the sons of Israel to see if they are going to follow God's ways or not. And of course, as we hear, they don't all the time. Now, the five lords of the Philistines, back to those just for a second. So there's you could spend probably years reading the scholarly literature about the history of the Philistines, where they came from, who they are. But it seems that at least the consensus is that they migrated down from Anatolia. They're sometimes called the Sea Peoples. And they probably, their ultimate goal as they moved southward was actually to infiltrate Egypt. But we know there were several clashes between the Egyptians and these Sea Peoples So chances are they were rebuffed before they got to Egypt. And what they ended up doing was settling there on the Mediterranean coast, which is where this Philistine Pentapolis is at. So these five cities like Gath and Ashkelon and Gaza that we hear about in multiple places in the scriptures, that was the Philistine territory. So they are on the western side of Israel, and they're a pretty unified bunch of peoples, and very, very equipped to fight. And we're going to hear a lot more about the Philistines as we go through the book of Judges, and of course all the way into the story of young David as well. Well, anyway, that's just kind of the beginning, that last of chapter two and beginning of chapter three. Now, without further ado, let's re-meet our first judge. So we're at verse five in Judges chapter three. It says the Israelites lived among, right away, as soon as we hear that, it's like, oh, this is not going to be good. They lived among, they cohabited with the Canaanites and the Hivites, the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites, and the Hivites and the Jebusites, all these various people groups that were natives of the land. So first of all, you kind of listen to the verbs that are used. Okay, so they lived among, that's the first one, and they took their daughters for themselves as wives and gave their own daughters to their sons and served their gods. And then it goes on to say that the Israelites did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherot. So that's a lot of piling up of verbs that describe all the various ways in which the Israelites were failing the test. They lived among these various people groups instead of conquering and executing them, which was the divine mandate. And then they intermarried, and they took the Canaanite wives for their sons or for themselves, and then they gave their Israelite daughters to Canaanite men. And of course, this breaking of the marriage laws is very frequently a metaphor for the breaking of the first commandment, for the committing of idolatry. And that's exactly, these two are joined. They are put right together in the same verse. So you have these prohibited marriages going on, and you have the prohibited service of their gods, with the net result that they forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherah. Now, we've talked a lot about remember in the scriptures. If you're a longtime listener, you know that we've talked about that over and over. Well, the flip side of that is to forget. So it's kind of what you'd expect. If when God remembers, or when people remember, they always are enacting something. When you forget, you're not enacting something. So it's more, of course, than just a mental lapse. It's like a refusal to do something, this particular kind of forgetting. I mean, the closest we come into English, usually when we say forget, we mean, yeah, I just, you know, I didn't think about it. It slipped my mind. But sometimes we'll say, like, if we're really mad, you know, we're done with somebody, we'll say, forget you, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. And we don't mean, I'm no longer going to think about you. It's like, we have rejected you, forget you. So you're out of my life, you're out of my mind, or whatever we might mean. Well, that kind of captures the meaning of the Hebrew word for forget. So anyway, this is the situation that Israel is now in. We have all of these things that they're doing, which are contrary to the Torah of Moses. So what happens? Well, verse 8, this is the cycle, right? First, Israel relapses into their idolatry, and then the anger of God is kindled against Israel. That's verse 8. And he sells them. We've encountered that particular word before. He sold them into the hands of this guy who's a Mesopotamian king, which is kind of strange. I mean, you'd think that he would sell them into like a Hittite king or an Amorite king or a Canaanite king. Mesopotamia is like way to the east. It's like on the other side of the Jordan. Mesopotamia means the land between two rivers, which is the Tigris and Euphrates. So this is a long way off. This guy, this Mesopotamian king, it's got a long name, Cushan Rishathaim. And anyway, he becomes the one who dominates Israel for 8 years. So this is this beginning of that cycle that we're going to see over and over. Israel rebels, and then God gets angry, and then God hands him over to somebody else. It's kind of like it's the pattern that we have throughout the scriptures, that God hands you over to that which you, that evil desire that you think that you want. So he's like, oh, so you want to, like, you want to live with and intermarry all of these other peoples. Okay, well, I'm just going to give you completely to this other person, and he's going to be your overlord. And this goes on for eight years, rather. And then the next stage happens. They cry out to God, and he raises up a deliverer, a Moshiach, one who's basically a savior. He's going to be a military deliverer for Israel. And this guy we have met before. We heard about him in the first chapter of Judges. We heard about him already back in Joshua, and his name is Othniel. He is the nephew of Caleb. When we first heard about him, you know, there was a city that Caleb wanted to capture, and he's like, hey, if any of you guys are brave and strong enough to capture the city, I'll give you my daughter Oxa as a wife. And so his nephew steps up, and he's like, yeah, I'd like to marry my cousin. So he captures the city, and he gets Oxa as his wife. Well, this is the guy. He's our first judge. And if you remember from our earlier conversations, he's not a native Israelite. Sometime along the way, he was part of a clan known as the what were their names? The Kenizzites. And they were adopted into Israel. So he comes from, just like Caleb, he comes from originally from a non-Israelite tribe. But this non-Israelite group of people, they became parts of the nation of Israel. Of course, Caleb is one of the great leaders of Israel. Well, Othniel then becomes our first judge, our first deliverer. And it says the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. This is the kind of language, again, this is we're kind of being introduced to this that we're going to see later in Judges. Very often, the Spirit of Yahweh is just comes upon them or falls upon them or moves them. And as a result of this, it's kind of like the equivalent of the divine hand. The hand of the Lord does a lot of things in the Old Testament. The Spirit of the Lord is fulfilling the same task here. And what he does is he empowers Othniel to be able to defeat the enemy. So he goes out to war, and it says the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, and so he prevailed. And then we finally get to the last stage of this rhythm of these various judges. So Israel sins. God sells them into the hand of somebody else. They cry out. God raises up a deliverer. That deliverer saves them. And then the final part of this particular cycle is that the land has rest. And in this particular case, it has rest for 40 years, which is probably, it's kind of a round figure. The Bible often does that. Don't take all of these particular references to time with strict literalness. 40 years is kind of a generation. So for a generation, Israel had rest. Now, this particular judge is interesting is in that there's nothing negative at all about him. I mean, nothing that's like made explicit about him. He's just kind of God decided he was going to use in order to deliver Israel. He's very different from most of the other judges, not all of them, but most of the judges, because most of the judges they got all kinds of flaws and they make all sorts of mistakes, and maybe they start out okay, but they end up bad like Gideon does. Othniel is different. Not a word of criticism breathed about him, but after that, things will fall apart pretty quickly.
One of the things I think is interesting is that it doesn't say so the land had peace for 40 years. It says that they had rest, and that rest is a word that the Bible will use when it's talking about things being as they should be, right? So because it's almost like when you think about rest. Like rest is when we do rest, when we have rest, this means that we're not doing that hard thing. You're like, I just need to go. I'm gonna go rest, or you're gonna go to sleep, right? Or you're feeling sick, and you say, go get some rest. You know, because you're dealing with this. I mean, ever since Genesis, we've seen this is conflict. The word that is chosen to describe when things are good is rest. And of course, we see this in the New Testament too. Jesus talks about rest a ton. And it seems that all throughout scriptures from the fall on, that the thing that is very, very elusive is rest, right? Yeah. I mean, God has to like put a day in place and like that's a day of rest, right? I mean, like, it's just like something that like you cannot keep for very long. Like, you cannot keep this state of rest. And I think this has implications when you start talking about the gospel, and then the gospel is this thing that is promises rest, permanent rest, a state of rest forever. And this is why we say things like resting in Christ and this kind of stuff, right? That, but it seems like rest is the thing that you can never, you get it and it's, and you have it for a moment and it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fantastic point. And I mean, it's exemplified, well, certainly in the book of Judges, because over and over God has to give them rest, but then it ends.
Yeah.
It's temporary. And when you get to the book of Hebrews, I think it's chapter 5, it talks about the Sabbath rest, talks about Joshua gave them rest, but not really gave them rest. And Psalm 95 talks about another rest. And then he finally gets the point saying that Christ is then our Sabbath rest. It's like this whole story about all this upheaval and this ephemeral nature of rest and just how easy it is to lose, that all of that was God's way of indicating that, yeah, it's because you don't have the perfect rest yet. And I'm gonna give it to you. I mean, that's a, talk about a gospel message for our world too. You know, we have all of these improvements in society, which you would think would give us more rest, but very often it just kind of takes over lives. And so, you know, people are craving some kind of rest. And of course they're looking for it everywhere, but it's only found in the same one who's always given people rest.
A movie I watched a lot growing up as a kid, because I had sisters and they loved this movie. So there's this movie called While You Were Sleeping that we used to watch all the time. The dad in this movie tells his son, the thing that you work for your whole life is this one moment where all the bills are paid and there are no crises and everyone is healthy and you get it and it's gone.
Oh, and, wow.
And this is exactly right. I should be deeply theological about this, where it's like, if I could just have like everything be okay for just a second.
Yeah,
I could. And what he's saying is like, at that moment, like, what do you have in that moment? In that moment, you have rest. You're like, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
And then something happens and it falls apart. Yeah. And we all know this is how it works, right?
That is exactly the way life works. Yeah. 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 Which is why, you know, when you hear the gospel about the rest that we have in Christ, man, when you really understand the message that is conveying, it's such comfort.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it doesn't matter how well put together you may think that your life is. Well, something's going to happen. It always does. You know, even if that rest lasts longer than a second, maybe it lasts a day or whatever it might be. Well, you're going to get sick, you know, or something's going to happen with your job, or something's going to happen with someone you love. Something's always going to happen that particular rest is going to end as a result. But but the rest we have in Christ, thankfully, is a gift, and so it can't be taken.
Yeah, what the gospel does is it gives you a rest that is outside of yourself and is unaffected by circumstances. It doesn't shift based on whatever else is going on.
Yeah, it's not self-created, and so it can't be self-destroyed.
Right.
Yeah, it comes from another.
Yeah, and so I mean, this is a good big deal for Israel here. They got 40 years of everything largely speaking, okay. Everything's as it should be.
Yeah, at least they're not under the dictatorship of a foreign power. But it's always a but, right? You get past verse 11 and you get to verse 12. And here's where we get to one of my favorite stories. So verse 12 through almost the end of the chapter. We have one verse at the end that's about our third judge, a guy named Shamgar. We'll get to him later. But now we're introduced to the fellow who's named Ehud. Ehud, however you want to say his name. Now, I don't even know how to begin this story because there is so much here that I don't want to get ahead of myself, but I think there is more like double entendres and sarcasm and wit and irony and satire and all of that that are compressed into this particular story, more so than maybe any other story in scripture. So anyway, well, without further ado, here we go. Verse 12. So again, the Israelites did evil in God's sight. And so this time, instead of reaching all the way over to Mesopotamia, the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in his sight. So Moab, as you might remember, was actually related to the Israelites because Lot's two daughters, they had two sons, and one of them was the Moabites, the father of the Moabites. So we have the Moabites, and they live on the eastern side of the Jordan, and their king is named Eglon. Now, right away, if you're a Hebrew listener to this, you're thinking, Eglon, that sounds a whole lot like our word for calf, like a fattened calf that would be ready for the slaughter. So right away, his name itself is like, I wonder if something's up here. Eglon, Egel, this king and a calf. Well, we'll see. So he is the king of Moab. Now, what did he do? Verse 13, he said he gathered to himself a couple of allies, the sons of Ammon and Amalek. Now, these are the Amalekites in particular are the ancient enemies of the people of Israel. They attacked their rear guard when they were leaving Egypt. And they're going to continue to be a menace to Israel for a long time. We're still going to hear about the Amalekites when we get into the story of Saul in Samuel. So anyway, he's not alone. It's kind of a triple point here. You got Moab, you got Ammon, you got Amalek, and they go and they defeat Israel, and they possess the city of palm trees, which is probably a reference to Jericho. Now, I'm not saying the city of Jericho was rebuilt, but no doubt there were some settlements around there. So the city of palm trees usually is a reference to Jericho. And how long were they under the thumb of Eglon? Well, 18 years is how long that they served him. So a little bit longer than last time when they were under the king of Mesopotamia is 8 years. When they're under him, we have 10 years added to that. So 18 long years. So we have the same pattern, right? Israel sins, make God mad. He sells them into the hand of somebody else. So far, we know what's happening. And we know what's happening in verse 15, because what's going to happen next? Well, the Israelites are going to cry out to God. So they do, and he raises up Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. Now, anytime, we've talked about this maybe once or twice, and we'll see a lot more occurrences as we go through the rest of the story, but almost every time that you have a physical detail added about a person, it's significant. It's one of the differences between reading the Bible and reading like a modern novel. You know, if you read a novel, there's a whole lot of description. I mean, when they introduce characters, you're going to know how tall they are and what color hair they have and what they're wearing and all of these particular details. It's just the way a novelist fills out the portrait of the characters. Not so in the Bible. The Bible is very scarce when it comes to giving physical descriptions of people. Now, we have some exceptions to this. We knew about Esau's, the way that Esau looked. He was hairy. Well, that was significant because that was the source of his name. We'll find out later about David and the way he looked, and Saul, how tall he was. So here we're introduced to Ehud as a left-handed man, and this particular description is gonna become significant as we move farther on. But what I want to point out, first of all, is already you have a built-in irony here, because Benjamin, Ben Yamin in Hebrew, means son of the right hand. So he is a left-handed man from a right-handed tribe. Now, we're not exactly sure. Let me put it this way. So the Hebrew for left-handed is a little bit ambiguous. It could mean he was just literally left-handed, just like people are today. But the word that's used there is actually refers to the binding up of the right hand. And the same expression is used later in the book of Judges to describe this whole group of warriors who could sling a stone accurately with their left hand. Now, to have just like by chance a whole bunch of left-handed stone slingers is pretty impossible. So what a lot of people suggest here is that actually he was trained to use his left hand. So they actually tied up the hands of the right hands of these warriors so they would have to use their left hand, thus making them, in the end, ambidextrous. So that's one possible meaning on this particular phrase. But anyway, the irony is there. He's from the right-handed tribe, and he's a left-handed dude. And they chose him, it says, to send tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. But Ehud has a plan. It says that before he went, he made himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, so about, around 18 inches, something like that. And he bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. So right away, you know that Ehud is a pretty tricky kind of guy. He's left-handed, but he ties it on his right thigh in order to conceal it. That's not the place that they would expect him to be carrying a weapon. And he then goes, verse 17, to present the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, we're told, another physical detail. We know that Ehud is left-handed, and now we're told that Eglon was a very fat man. Now, it's even richer in the Hebrew, because the word that's used there for fat is not the typical word that we would use to describe someone, the lower weight. This is the word that's typically used to describe animals, like someone who's an animal that's fattened for the slaughter. So we have a left-handed guy, and we have a very short sword, and we have a fat king. So I wonder what's going to happen. Well, we'll find out. So verse 18 says, it came about when he finished presenting the tribute that he sent the people away who had carried the tribute. So he doesn't go there alone. He has these other guys. And he turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And the king says, keep silence. And all who attended left him. Now there's another little irony, not irony here, but kind of a double meaning here. Because when the Hebrew there, when he says a secret message, is a secret devar. The word devar can mean a message, a word, but it can also mean an object, a thing. So Ehud is saying, I have a secret devar for you. Now, Eglon interprets this to mean, oh, he's got like some kind of special report, some kind of special word that he's going to speak to me. But Ehud means something very different. He's got a secret devar for him that has two blades and that is currently strapped to his right thigh. But Eglon, he doesn't get this. So all who attended him left. And Ehud, it says, came to him while he was sitting alone in his, well, somewhere. My translation has cool roof chamber. We're not exactly sure where this place was. A cool roof chamber, like upper throne room. Some people think it's like close to a bathroom. Anyway, we'll get to that eventually. Ehud says again, this time he doesn't say secret message. He says, I have a message from God for you.
If you're casting this in a movie, like, can you imagine? This is like Clint Eastwood, rolling up and be like, I got a message from God for you. And you just know, like, oh, this is not good.
This is not good. I know. Yeah. So Eglon is just, he's a little dense. You got an enemy there. You don't send out all of your soldiers. He sends everybody out just on the basis of what this guy says. Yeah, I got a message from God for you. And he gets up from his seat next. And then Ehud makes his move, stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. And if you're eating right now, you might want to move your plate away, move a little from the table. Because it says the handle also went in after the blade and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of the belly. And we're not done yet. Sorry. And the the refuse came out. This was not a pretty scene. So the fat king actually ended up swallowing the entire 18 inches of the blade. And not only that, but, you know, things happened. Some pretty unsightly things happened when this was going out, when this was happening. And I'll explain the reason why some of this is included in just a minute. So Ehud's job is done, at least at this point. So he sneaks out somehow. The architecture here is a little confusing, but anyway, however he does it, he gets out and he locks the doors behind him. Well, he takes off. He goes out, his servants came and looked, and look, the doors were locked. And so they come to the doors and they say, oh, he's probably relieving himself in the cool room. Now, again, I don't want to get all gross on you here, but probably the reason they thought he was relieving himself because there was a certain smell that was coming from the room that he was in. That's why these bodily functions were mentioned earlier. So they wait, verse 25, until they become anxious and he doesn't open the doors. It's the finally like somebody find the spare keys. So somebody gets the spare key, opens the door, and behold, verse 25, their master had fallen to the floor dead. So Ehud escapes while they were dilly-dallying around. He goes by the idols. He escapes to a place called Sarah, and he's ready. He's got a trumpet. He blows the trumpet, and he gathers together all of these folks in the hill country, and he says to them, pursue them, because the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hands. So they go down, and they block the river, so the Moabites can't get across, and they ended up killing, it says, 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel. And the land was undisturbed for 80 years this time. Quite the story for a lot of different reasons. You know, I think this is significant because, I mean, this is undoubtedly written as satire. At least I'm convinced it was. And it shows you that the Israelites they didn't consider like making fun of their enemies to be somehow below them. They did that actually with great gusto many times. And even when you get to the book of Revelation and Babylon falls, Babylon, you know, that great symbol of ungodly power, the saints rejoice over this fall. And of course, that's, you know, exactly what's happening here. Now, we can debate all of the ways that Ehud went about his particular way of delivering Israel. But in the end, he got the job done. And in the end, this is the book of Judges. And strange things happen. God's ways of delivering his people are not always what you would expect.
It is true that when God gives his people over to somebody and then decides to deliver them, it almost seems like, man, this deliverance seems like no big deal. Like, why didn't Israel just rise up and do this? Because it seems like it's always this way. When God determines that now is time, it's just got a complete wipeout. And you'd think, like, I guess you could have done this whenever, right?
Yeah, why'd you wait so long?
Yeah. And this is always done to illustrate that, you know, when God deals with his enemies, like it's never like this close fight.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. It's always just a complete deliverance, right? And it has to be in these situations because, I mean, they're living it close to each other, right? So you got to wipe the, you got to have such a resounding defeat that this wouldn't be like some ongoing, you know, and then they were in conflict for the next 10 years or something, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You do see that kind of just complete destruction of the enemy multiple times. And yeah, for good reason, as you point out. Otherwise, well, in 6 more months, you're going to have to be dealing with this problem again.
Yeah, and that's not rest.
No, and that's definitely not rest. Not for 80 years, for sure. Well, we covered two judges so far.
Two Othniel judges?
Othniel and Ehud. Yeah.
Two judges, one chapter.
Yeah, next time we'll get to our one verse judge. We don't know much about him, but we'll cover him next time, and then we'll get to the great story of Deborah and Barak and a lady that you want to stay away from if she has a hammer and a tent peg in her hand.
Yeah, she has a message from God for somebody too.
She's got another message from God. That's right.
Similar in nature. It's similar yeah. results.
Yes, yes.
Well, all right, guys, that is 40 minutes. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by going over to 1517.org, and you can go to the donate page, and you can become a contributor there. Thank you so much to those of you who support what we do. Also, if you wouldn't mind going and rating and reviewing on iTunes, that really helps as well. It helps give us more visibility. So if you've never rated the podcast over there and dropped that 5-star rating, that also helps us out. Costs you nothing. It's a free way to help us out. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.